from KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, three of the leading Bay Area food, wine, and restaurant critics join us for an hour devoted on where and what to eat and drink. Narcy David, Michael Bauer, and Jan Newberry will be joining us along with your calls and emails coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. In this morning's second hour, we want to focus our attention on food, wine, and Northern California restaurants as we bring together a mighty trio of Northern California's finest food, wine, and restaurant critics, experts. Let me tell you who's joining us for the hour. Narcy David is food and wine editor at KCBS Radio, culinary expert at Macy's. Morning, Narcy.
Hello, Michael. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. Also good to have Michael Bauer with us, food and wine editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. Good
Hello.
Morning. And Jan Newberry, who's food editor at San Francisco Magazine. Welcome.
Hi, Michael.
Glad to have you all here. And as I said, you can turn everything into product after a while in radio. And lo and behold, what are we talking about off air here? We're going to talk about trends and tips in restaurants and in food, but about the charges going up. And what were you saying, Michael? The average was about $115 for two people,
I mean,
and now it's up $20 or something?
Yeah, when I'll go out for two people, it'd usually be about $110, $115. And this year, it's gone up to where it's about $135 or $140. And places like Boulevard, for example, that used to be kind of high moderate, now their main courses start at $32 and go to $42. I mean, it's just amazing, the prices.
I got a question about Boulevard right off the bat, but corkage is a lot of this, Narcy, no?
Well, I don't know that it's a lot of it, because in some of these restaurants it's gotten to the point that it's sometimes cheaper to not bring your own wine. When they're charging $25 seems to be a minimum for a lot of restaurants. I've seen $30 and $35. And then restaurants that will put a restriction of not more than two bottles that you could bring in yourself. And I'm thinking to myself, now wait a minute. We went into a restaurant with a party of 10 people. We were only allowed two bottles that we could pay corkage on at $30 a bottle. But if a deuce walked in, they could have brought in two bottles. It's as if the restaurateurs have found a way to be punitive about the wine. Either you drink the wine the way they present it, or you shouldn't drink any wine.
And what about, Jan, what about labor costs? You know, I was looking at Patty Enterman's new book, new edition, I should say, A San Francisco Food Lover's Guide. And I remember Patty talking about how difficult it is with the costs of living in town and in the Bay Area in general to get people to work in restaurants, and how wages have gone up and so forth.
It's very expensive proposition. There's the new minimum wage law now, which extends to the waiters, who now they can do quite well now because they're getting paid minimum wage. I forget what the exact rate is right now, but it's pretty comfortable when you're getting $200 a night in cash tips on top of a salary. So for the restaurateurs to pick that up, they were not very happy about it last year when that went through. And it's a huge expense for them across the board. You know, they don't mind paying it to the dishwashers and right. to the employees who aren't tipped. But often the waiters are the best paid employee in the restaurant.
And also
they make more than the kitchen folks.
And also ingredients are up.
And, oh, the ingredients
and
are
utilities are up. So, I mean, there are some reasons for it.
Some real cost rising, yeah. You mentioned Boulevard. Lo and behold, probably still the best restaurant, according to most lights, or along with Gary Denko, the best restaurant, at least in San Francisco. An experience there recently, though. I ate at right by the kitchen, you know, where you sit on a stool, and I get this pet peeve on the air here. There's marble there, and they put down, I mean, because it's elegant looking, and I think this is Nancy Oak's idea of elegance, too. Put down the silverware, but there's no napkins underneath. And this is done in a lot of restaurants. And I'm thinking to myself, shouldn't there be napkins underneath? Isn't that simply more bacteria-minded?
You mean you have your napkin in your lap, though, right?
The napkin is in the lap. It's put on your lap. The silverware is put right on the marble
right.
or on the table.
Not without a tablecloth.
Without any
right.
tablecloth, without any napkin.
Come on,
underneath.
Michael. You're getting a little too fussy. You wouldn't complain if that was sitting on the table, if you were seated at a table that had a Formica top or
I might.
Marble top.
Yeah, I might.
You know, and marble is not a surface where bacteria really thrives.
No, I know that's certainly true.
So I think you're safe.
A lot of tables, I noticed, they just don't put a tablecloth on. And it is in the idea of aesthetics, I guess, really, that it looks cleaner or it looks nicer.
I guess I'm a little baffled. Let's say that they had put a napkin down underneath your silverware.
Or a tablecloth.
Well, no, but if it's tablecloth, then you're no longer sitting at the counter.
All right, a countercloth.
Well, they could put a placemat down.
Yeah, they could have put a placemat down, right?
Boy, I'd rather have my silverware off that marble counter than off a placemat. Can you imagine that placemat by the time it's been used a few times?
Supposedly they would change it.
They sure they changed it. Yeah. You know, put your silverware on your plate. That's
there
where
you
it
go.
Belongs.
Well, I'm not going to do a whole hour here on germs.
That's another show.
Done that, actually. You're right. Let's talk about some things that are happening out there, Narcy. And meat is on the rise in this vegan and vegetarian saturated Bay Area. It's in again, really, isn't it?
My goodness, is it ever. And every day you walk into a supermarket, you find more varieties of beef. The free range fed beef made it big a couple of years ago,
and now my beef is with the tables.
Yeah. and pretty soon there were people promoting the fact that their animals were not fed any non vegetarian product, but they were still finishing them on grain, which goes completely in the face of the ones that started the range feed operation. But people are really interested. Steakhouses are opening all over the country. More and more people are eating meat, and red beef is what it's all about, it seems.
Or more organic and free range and all that?
Well, there's not much organic beef yet,
shell type beef.
Yeah, there's a lot of claims that they do not use any hormones, they do not use any antibiotics, they do not feed any animal source material in their feed. But you don't see very much that's actually organic.
There are, right on Van Ness, for example, three pretty good steakhouses as these things fly. I'm thinking Ruth Chris, Harris's, though not necessarily what it used to be. It's very different than what it used to be. House Prime Rib, I mean, right within a kind of few
yeah,
blocks.
Sure, we're close to each other.
But those have all been there for years.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in
what's
the
new,
other
Michael?
Parts, well, in the other part of the world, the country, there are a lot of steakhouses. Here, it's really been slow. I mean, I think we've always kind of had a moderate approach to most things. So you have a couple like CNL, and my favorite is El Ragon that just opened last year in North Beach, which is an Argentinian steakhouse.
And the last time Thomas Keller was on this program speaking about meat, Jan Newberry, mm-hmm. he confessed that he loves In-N-Out Burgers.
I have heard that from him before.
And so do a lot of people. Yeah,
it's good food. You know, what I wanted to point out about the meat and the trend in the meat is a lot of organ meats becoming much more popular and seeing these on menus. I see a lot of sweetbread salads when I go out. The tripe dish at A16, I know, is very, very popular. Over at Encanto, Chris Constantino has beef heart on the menu. I think all the time, and a lot of other organ meats. And I think I know chefs love that kind of food, and I think that here in the Bay Area we have a very sophisticated group of diners who are willing to try these things. And I think that's a very interesting trend.
And it was interesting about 10 years ago, Wolfgang Puck, when he opened Post Trio, said the reason he loved cooking here more than in Northern or Southern California was that here we would eat organ meats.
Right.
And
yeah, but
please
don't forget the way these things go in cycles. 25 years ago, organ meats were not a bit unusual in restaurants,
exactly.
But they really pretty much disappeared.
Right.
10 years ago, as little as 5 years ago, you could hardly give away sweetbreads. When's the last time you saw kidneys on the menu? Even though the organ meats are coming back, you'll see heart and liver and sweetbreads occasionally. I don't know anybody that's got kidneys back on the
you
menu
don't see
yet.
Kidneys.
But they're starting to come back. Sweetbreads seemed like they were gone forever. And then, of course, with the BSE scare, nobody wanted to have anything to do with brains, and
right.
I suspect it'll be a long while before you see brains coming right. back on menus.
Yeah, just so people know what sweetbreads really are. I was also noticing I referenced Patty Unterman's new book. She says two big new trends in restaurants, the popularity of small plate menus. Michael, you certainly have addressed that. Allow people to spend less and eat less, and a growing number of high-quality new restaurants in outer neighborhoods like the Lower Haight, Outer Noe Valley, and the Mission, where commercial rents are cheaper. She's right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's all happening now. We'll talk about the smaller plates, though, because this is really a phenomenon.
It is. I think it started here. I think it's all across the country now. Although there's also another trend that's not so good, which is that they just really cut down main courses by about a half and charge two-thirds of the price. So in that regard, it also becomes more of a profit center for restaurants. And also it's easier for them to handle in the kitchen because they don't have to time things. So when it's done well, I love it. When it's done as a trend, which it is in some restaurants, I hate it.
I would agree with Michael on that. It can get – there's places that do it beautifully. I would point out Bocadillos is one of them where he's really got – Gerard Hurd going in there has really got it down. But other restaurants, I just feel that I'm being ripped off. You know, you order a bunch of dishes because they all seem relatively inexpensive. You get your check and, you know, your heart leaps into your throat. And it's just not as interesting sometimes. So it needs to be done well. It's not just something anyone can just – throw a little bit less food on a little smaller plate, and you know.
Well, I'd like to add too on that question of cost. It really is only less expensive if you have a very, very small appetite,
exactly.
And you want a very, very light meal. Because if you go in expecting to eat the same amount of food you would in a regular, in a more traditional menu where you have an appetizer, a main course, and a dessert, then it's likely to cost a lot more than it would in a traditional restaurant. Mm-hmm. So, to think that small plates means cheaper food is really a little bit of a misleading element.
It's getting spicier too, though, isn't it, Jan, by and large?
Yeah, I think that chefs, you know, that's just a way I think the American palate has been going. I don't necessarily love it in all instances, but definitely you'll see a lot of bold flavors in food. But I think a really talented chef can serve a subtle dish and really show off the beauty of those ingredients. That takes a lot more talent than just throwing in a lot of spices and things like that to show off the real flavors of those dishes and let it be subtle.
Talking about food, restaurant, and we'll be talking about wine shortly as well with Narcy David, Michael Bauer, and Jan Newberry. Narcy talked about the fact that, in fact, this I actually experienced this. I went to there was a First Crush out in Mill Valley and went to it over the weekend, closed down. It's a new high-end Mexican restaurant coming here. That's kind of a microcosm in a way, isn't it? I mean, new high-end Mexican restaurants are kind of burgeoning.
Well, I sure think that Mexican food is on the upswing, and it's about time. You know, some of the most interesting food in the world comes from just south of the border, and you'd never know that California was next to Mexico if you look at Mexican food in California. I mean, for years we were saying the best Mexican food in America was, for goodness sakes, in Chicago, where the Baylesses created Topolobampo and the Frontera. But
well, and Texas, too, has a lot more influence than we do in California.
Tex-Mex.
Yeah.
But that's Tex-Mex. That's a different thing.
It's a hybrid.
You know, what Rick Bayless did in Chicago was to really recreate classic Mexican dishes. In California, we've had...
You mean Chevy's is not?
tacos and tamales and enchiladas and lots of refried beans. Well, if you get out into the provinces of Mexico, the food is so exciting. And I guess the first step in that direction was probably Cafe Marimba in modern times in San Francisco. There's Doña Tomas in Oakland and Picante in Berkeley, and more places are heading in that direction, and I'm delighted. I'm really pleased to see it.
I wanted to talk about wines with all of you, and again, since we're talking about trends here, Michael, Narcy's bothered about wines that are winning awards, feels they're too high in alcohol and probably fruit forward. I'm also bothered by the fact that ever since Sideways, nobody seems to want to drink Merlot. But maybe that's
but more for you.
Now, wait a minute. I've got a Merlot vineyard in the Napa Valley. And I'm a little worried about that.
On the other hand, I think, Michael, you were saying there are certain wines you just can't go wrong with. Let's talk about that.
Right. Yeah. You mean with restaurant food?
Yeah, with restaurant
food. You know, to me, it's Pinot Noir, number one. I generally would not have a Chardonnay with most food. If I was going to do a white, it would be a Riesling or some Sauvignon Blancs. But it's interesting the way I kind of go from my 12 years of being a restaurant critic here. You know, I started with Pinot Noir because it was cheaper. Then all of a sudden it was discovered, so I went to Zinfandel. Then, of course, it became expensive, so then it was Syrah. And so now I guess it's Sangiovese or, you know, Argentina.
Hey, you like Argentinian. You're bullish on New Zealand wines too now, right?
Yeah. I love the Sauvignon Blancs in particular.
And you, Jen?
You know, I wanted to say I went to one of the trend. There is a small burgeoning trend towards less expensive wines. And I went to the new wine shop, Vintage Berkeley, on Friday. And they have one wine that's $25. Everything else is under $20 there. And a wonderful selection of wines. I got some great Spanish bargains there. Very knowledgeable staff. And it was really fun. It was, you know, it was exciting to go into a wine shop and feel that it was accessible to you, that the prices weren't we're not in control. And discover some new wines.
Well, I must tell you a story, and what this is revelatory of, I'm not sure, but some people invited us over for dinner and asked to bring wines of all different varieties and samplings, and the wines were wrapped in aluminum foil so nobody could tell what they were. And they had a two-buck chuck wine in the midst of all of these pretty nice wines and so forth. And people were asked to rate them. The two-buck chuck wine did pretty well. I mean, right up there with all these fine wines.
Keep in mind, though, that two-buck chuck sells so many millions of cases that what you get one time might be entirely different from what you get the next time. That's been such a phenomenal success story that they couldn't possibly produce enough wine to be consistent. So you may have a batch that's really a splendid bargain, and the very next bottle, well, maybe doesn't quite do it. So be aware, if you only paid $2 for it, you can't complain.
Or maybe our palates are in Europe, too. That's a possibility that occurred to me.
If you were drinking that much wine after a while.
Yeah, it's safe to say, though, that well, actually, there are really some wonderful wines out there. I mean, and California wine still ought to be cherished by Californians. I mean, the battles still continue and so forth over what to import and what to have in your cellar and all that sort of thing. But we've got some great wines here, Narcy, right?
Oh, my goodness, absolutely. I cut my eye teeth on California wine. That's how I learned how to drink wine. And there's no doubt that some of the best wine in the world is made here. To be honest with you, I've often spoken of how California cuisine really got started around California wine. It's not a bit surprising that this all happened in the Bay Area, which is the very, you know, the nerve center of what has come to be contemporary American cuisine and happens to be the very heart of the great wine industry. Prices are a funny thing. There are periods in history when it was a lot cheaper to drink French wine, and now it's getting to the point that it's getting to be cheaper to drink California wine because the dollar is so weak against foreign currencies. So it swings up and down, and we go through these funny phases. It's certainly true that our Chardonnays and our Zinfandels have gotten so alcoholic that it's embarrassing. I mean, you see a Zinfandel at 16 or 17% alcohol. My goodness, it's supposed to be a table wine. You drink a bottle of that with dinner, and you fall asleep before you make it to the couch. So we go through some funny phases as more and more new wineries come online and the new winemakers want to try their hand and they experiment with it. I'm hoping and praying that the alcohol is going to settle down in the Chardonnay and in the Zinfandel particularly.
Well, what restaurants in Northern California have the great wine cellars? I mean, and by your quantifying and measuring things, Jan or Michael?
I think, of course, Rubicon, because
right.
of Larry Stone. But, you know, Acarello has some really great Italian wines. Most of the high end, I always gravitate towards, frankly, the smaller, more personal lists, like you get at Encanto.
Right. I think at A16, she's got a really interesting
Yeah,
list.
She's really good.
Shelley Lindgren over there has really developed just such an interesting collection of wines. I always have something, discover something new there.
Back to food for just a moment. Then I want to get a kind of a restaurant tip from each of you, which is always dangerous because, you know, you talk about a restaurant that you love and then suddenly it's overcrowded. But there's a sense, just in terms of movements and trends, this slow food movement really seems to have taken hold out here. I mean, it's got some legs, hasn't it?
You know, I have a five-year-old in one of the Oakland schools, and there's a gardening program and a burgeoning culinary program in the school there. And the slow food is really a part of it, of trying to get it to the kids. And, you know, I was over at the Edible Schoolyard a couple weeks ago, and it's very much a part of, you know, now the curriculum for kids growing up in Bay Area schools are learning about food.
Thanks
from
to
this,
Alice
from
Waters
this perspective.
In many respects, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, she deserves certainly a lot.
I think they have a slow club. A slow food club.
The slow club is up the street here.
No, but there's a slow food club at one of the schools, I noticed, for the kids, you know, to really learn about food from this way. So that's really interesting.
Well, John DeLuca, who's a friend of mine who's, you know, was the muck-de-muck in the whole wine industry for years, is trying to start this movement, and I think it's a great idea to get, instead of all this kind of crap that they have in schools, in the public schools, get stuff, especially in the valley where they grow nice vegetables and get, you know, things into the schools like that. Instead of the homogenized and crappy stuff. Are we done with raw food? Is that thing over? Or?
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Yes.
It didn't last long.
No.
It lasted too long. Yes, it did.
You know, I applaud creative chefs who can take raw vegetables and fruit and make something exciting out of them that's not what it was intended to be. And if they were to do that as an appetizer course or something, it'd be a lot of fun, and I think that's neat. But when the movement got to the point that they were bold enough to suggest that it was better for human beings to eat the food raw because the enzymes did this or that or the other thing, and throughout history, well, you've got to go back more than a few hundred thousand years to the discovery of fire before you find a time when they truly ate raw food.
You'll probably hear from some listeners who will tell us arguments along those lines. Jan, give us maybe we got a few minutes till break here. Perhaps a little bit of an out-of-the-way place that people might not know about that you really cherish and that you are not hesitant or inhibited about spreading the good news on.
All right. Well, this has always been my old favorite. It's in downtown Oakland, and it's called Cafe 817. And it's not open for dinner. It's breakfast and lunch. Sandro has some absolutely incredible lunch specials. You'll go in there. I've had a porcini salad with big, thick slices of raw porcini all the time. I think about that dish all the time. A ribollito that he makes. A smoked pork chop. The kitchen is a quarter of the size of your studio, Michael. He doesn't have an oven. He has a hot plate and I think a toaster oven. And turns out some of the most delicious Italian food in the city. Excellent coffee. And the mornings, poached egg on polenta with fontina cheese folded into the polenta. And it's really just a charming little cafe. I wish that downtown Oakland will come around to the point where it could support dinner business for him because it kind of that neighborhood kind of dies at night. But during the morning and the afternoon, you get a lot of the lunch crowd from the courthouse and things like that. And it's been one of my favorite restaurants.
I can tell you're getting excited just talking about it.
It's really good.
But just a quick footnote here. You say lunches and not dinners. Often when you go to restaurants, you get a very different kind of meal if you're going for a lunch as opposed to going for a dinner. I mean, a lot of people think, well, go to this restaurant and I'll get what I would get normally, same chef and everything. Of course, it's not. And get a similar meal. It's not. It's a whole different dining experience in many respects. Michael, what about something along these lines? I mean, maybe a place that's not that well known that you would really give your imprimatur to?
You know, I actually end up writing about everything that I discover, so it's hard. But probably my latest is I just did a review a couple weeks ago. It's a Bounty Hunter in Napa. And this is a place that really does take wine down to the beer level. They've got a great wine list. But it's inexpensive. They do really wonderful food like beer can chicken, a whole chicken cooked on a Tecate can, where you end up just kind of ripping off the legs and eating it out of hand. You know, they have the old-fashioned artichoke dip that they serve with really very thin baguette slices that are toasted like potato chips. So everything they do is classic and you've heard of, but they do something to make it really stand out and make it special.
Narcy.
I guess I'm going to have to talk about Marica, M-A-R-I-C-A, on College Avenue in Oakland. Marica is a Greek word that for a sea nymph, and the food is primarily seafood. It's run by Christopher Chung, who had Christopher's
on. I love it. Greek name by a Chinese guy.
Oh, yeah, right. Greek name by a Chinese guy serving American food. And although it's primarily seafood, he always manages to have at least one or two non seafood dishes. There's a poultry dish and a meat dish frequently. But he just has the right touch to make it feel good. The prices are moderate. He just got a liquor license, and I'm not sure what that's going to do. He's also added some small plates because it seems like that's what people in the neighborhood were asking for. So I'm not sure what the impact of that liquor license is going to be, but we're just delighted with this food.
Well, we're delighted to have three of the preeminent food critics here with us in studio this hour. And let me give phone numbers out so that you can join us and talk to, between the three of them, who knows how many restaurants they've made and destroyed. You can join us now toll-free at 866-733-6786. You want to talk about restaurants, food, or wine? Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786. And feel free to join us if you're listening to us by Sirius Satellite or on the Internet. The other number locally here is 415-863-2476, and our email address for your emails, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny talking on and off air about restaurants, food, and wines with Jan Newberry and Michael Bauer and Narcy David, and be bringing your calls in just a moment. Again, you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, and in fact, let's go to them right now, and let's go first to Tim. You're on the air, Tim. Hi.
Hi. I actually just had a quick question for your panelists. I'm actually from the Bay Area. I do a lot of traveling. There's a local Santa Cruz winery called Bonnie Dune, and when I traveled in it, I was recently in Hawaii. Everywhere I went, all the restaurants served at least one Bonnie Dune. Outside of California, I frequently encounter this local winery, yet it when I eat within the Bay Area, I rarely encounter it. And I'm just sort of curious if your panelists knew anything about this. I mean, I really enjoy their wines, and I'm just sort of wondering why the Bay Area hasn't really discovered sort of a local, what I consider
getting
a favorite.
Smiles of recognition to your comments here, Tim. Who wants to jump right in here?
Well, Michael, I mean, Bauer? I think Randall Graham is a wonderful, wacky guy, and he's a great marketer. And actually, you do see a lot of his wines around.
Oh, yeah. It's around a lot more than you might think. Perhaps the unusual marketing that he does turns some people off. I think it's really exciting. And he comes up with some clever ideas. For Valentine's Day this year, he had a raspberry wine made in the style of a liqueur that he marketed in a box with a little piece of chocolate and a few other little tchotchkes in there. He really is
that's
a brilliant
Assyrian
marketer.
Word,
yeah, tchotchke, that's it. He comes up with some very creative ideas. I'm astounded at how broad-reaching his success is. He's a phenomenal success.
And some of his wines are quite good.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of very food-friendly wines, and he does a nice job.
Thank Tim for the call, and on we go. Christine, hi, you're on.
Hi. I live in Danville in the East Bay, and I wondered if your panel could talk about some of the restaurants that are out in this area.
You know, it's There are lots of – obviously, there are lots of restaurants, but in most cases, they are chains or branches of another. I think one in your area that I really like is called Vada V, which is in Walnut Creek. It's small plates. The chef was of Chinese heritage and Filipino, and he lived in Hawaii. And so you do get a mix of Mediterranean and Asian, but it really works, and the food is really good.
I guess I'd have to slip in a mention of Prima in Walnut Creek for some really very, very – beautifully presented Italian food and a great wine list, talking about wines once again.
And thank you for the call, Christine. We'll go to more of your calls in a moment here. But speaking of chains, I actually heard what was tantamount to a kind of vehement argument almost about Olive Garden. Now, I mean, I know this sounds like I'm being facetious, but one of the people who was arguing was saying it's much underrated. It's actually really good Italian food, and it's given short shrift and so forth. I don't know if anybody wants to comment on this, but I haven't had much experience eating at Olive Garden, so I have no idea.
I haven't been there for about 2 years. It was in the Midwest, so maybe it's better out here, but it wasn't very good there.
I've never been. So.
I've never been. I'm determined that one of these days I'm going to find time to go to all of these chain restaurants, but I don't have time to get to the restaurants that I really want to get to, so I sort of don't make it to some of these others.
Do you folks put much stock in Zagat's? Do you read it, and do you think it actually makes sense for people in terms of choosing restaurants?
In some cases, I mean, I think it's really great if you're out of town. It gives you a list of restaurants, addresses, and things like that. For the city that you actually live in, I'm not sure it's quite as useful.
But the concept, I mean, of actually going to a kind of Vox Populi or plebiscite for restaurants. You know?
I think the concept does not work, frankly. I think when you're going – if to use it as a listing of restaurants with addresses and phone numbers and so forth – and just as a place to look for ideas is fine. The trouble with the Vox Populi is if you get a large enough populace, then the numbers all average out and you no longer have any critique. So if it's just a listing that describes the places that a lot of people are talking about, then I think it serves an important function. But I'm not overly excited about what they consider the best restaurants because the popularity part of it is just too easily sidetracked, I think.
There's a lot of criticism. You know, I hear from restaurateurs who tell me
that
they get faxes every year when it's time for the Zagat to come out. They get all these faxes come across their fax machine from Zagat saying, fill out this form. And so there's no controls on who's voting for these things. And, you know, the restaurant owners and their staffs can sit down and fill out countless numbers of forms. People can vote for restaurants they've never eaten in. There's just no – it's not controlled in any way. So, you know, I think all of us – I have a Zagat in my car. You know, I know the address and the phone number, and it's a very useful, handy guide for that thing. And some of – you know, truly, some of the ratings, I look at them, and that is a good restaurant, and that is a bad restaurant. You know, that they're not necessarily wrong in how they rate the restaurants. But I think Michael's point, if you live in a city, you have other resources that I think are going to be more useful if you really want to – a serious critique of a restaurant.
We have the Chronicle, San Francisco Magazine, and KCBS. And we have Scott as our next caller. Hi, Scott.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I'm a little bit confused about how some of these rankings and restaurant ratings work. I went to Chez Panisse with a group of friends, and six of us uniformly were disappointed with the level of service, particularly the attitude of the wait staff. I mean, the food was fine, but the wait staff and the service that we got was just terrible. And, I mean, I've been to places like Olive Garden and Outback Steakhouse where the service is great, but the food, you know. So I don't understand how these rating systems work or how they come up with it, because a lot of times I just think the rating systems are just wrong.
Will we talk about rating systems here, folks?
Sure.
Michael Bauer?
You know, well, the problem with restaurants, unlike theater or other things like that or movies, is that they change every night. It's a human endeavor. So the service I get may be different from one night to the next, or it could be different from one table to the next. So what you try and do is to do an average. Chez Panisse, I think, is having some turnover in staff. And I would say that and Olivetto, when I give 4 stars or when I give high ratings, are the two that people most don't understand, because there are very few bells and whistles. Like Chez Panisse, what they offer is the best. Every time I've gone there, it'll be like the best asparagus I've ever had. It'll be that wow moment, like, wow, this is what pork is really supposed to taste like. But it's all simply prepared.
Because they know what you look like too, don't they?
Some.
I mean, you don't wear an iron mask or anything, right?
Like in a disguise sometimes, but no mask.
Recent episode of Monk where the restaurant critic came in some kind of mask. Yeah, but I think your point is certainly well taken, and let me thank the caller and get more of our callers on here. Lisa, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've listened to your show for a long time, and I have moved further east as I get older and started a family. We now live in Orinda, and I know you answered a call earlier from a woman from Danville. I want to know, what are some of the good restaurants in our area? And I do want to plug a restaurant that we discovered in Moraga, which is an Italian restaurant called Amaroma, and they serve authentic food of Rome. And really good food, very good service. So I'm going to let you answer my question.
Okay, what do we know about Orinda?
I am familiar with that restaurant, and it is very good. Probably another one that's very popular is Casa Orinda. And I go there once in a while. I love their fried chicken.
Great biscuits there, too.
Right.
And don't forget the prime rib. As long as you're there, they do something with sweetbreads all the time, too.
You know, I wanted to plug a resource for restaurants on the other side of the tunnel there. Because in San Francisco Magazine, we don't go generally that far out.
Are you going to talk about a sister magazine?
Diablo Magazine is a great resource for restaurants on that side, in that region. And you can check them out online or go to find out about those restaurants there.
And on we go. Benjamin, morning.
Morning. I was just curious how you guys picked the restaurants that you rate, because it seems like restaurants like Memphis Minis are going up on the same rating scale against places like A16 and Quince. And, you know, I'm a sous chef in the North Bay, and I understand how, like, a 2.5 stars is not a bad thing for a Memphis Minis. But I don't think the general public understands that. They just think that the food's not that good because they only got 2.5 stars.
Actually, I think 2.5 stars is very good for food.
Yeah.
So there's nothing shameful about that. But it is, you have to look at all these ratings, or at least at the Chronicle, and I have a feeling it's probably the same with San Francisco mm-hmm. Magazine, through kind of the focus of price. If you have a restaurant that you're going to spend $200 a person and it's 2.5 stars, that's not very good. But if you have a 2.5 star restaurant where you're spending $15, then that's really outstanding.
I agree with Michael there. I mean, the rating system is very difficult, and I think as food writers and editors here, we struggle with that. I know restaurants get very hung up on the star rating, you know, and I wish sometimes, like, just read the words, you know, don't look at the stars. I've had chefs call me up furious at a 3.5 star rating.
At least nobody's committing suicide like in Paris, right?
Right. So it's not, you know, read – I think if you – if you take time to read, you know, and everyone just wants that quick fix. You know, it's a 3-star restaurant, it's a 2-star restaurant. But I think if you actually take the time to read what the critic has written, you'll get a much better sense of if that's a place you want to go. And, you know, there are 2-star restaurants that are close to my heart that I would prefer sometimes over a restaurant that might have a 3-star rating. Mm-hmm. That's just where I want to go eat. So I think it's unfortunate that people have got so hung up on the star ratings.
Well, it's like the little man in the pink section a little bit.
Yes.
But, you know, they used to say baseball, 90% of the game was pitching. As I think about restaurant reviews and the restaurant reviews that I read, you know, you think about ambience, you think about price, service, preparation, fussy people like me, maybe sanitation, but 90% of it is food, really.
That's true. Well, wait a minute. 90% of it ought to be food.
Isn't it usually in most reviews?
I think it's been 20 years now since American Express did a survey of restaurant reviewers around the country. And when asked, would you rather eat at a restaurant where you knew the food was going to be really good and the service was terrible, or a restaurant where you knew the service was really fantastic and the food was just so-so? And the great majority of them chose the place that had the great service. Because
that's what they say.
Well, no, I think we have a whole generation of people that have forgotten what the word restaurateur means. You know, it's a simple French word. It's a restorer. One goes to a restaurant to be restored. That means to be taken care of, to be made to feel good. And there are just too many restaurants where they figure that since the food is good, they can just throw it at you and not have to worry about the rest of it. And I think that's a mistake. I think service is really, really important.
And so are our callers in Lincoln. You're up next. Morning.
Good morning. I used to eat at 3 restaurants in San Francisco that were the opposite of small plate. La Pantera, Days Alps, and Elu's Basque.
Uh-oh, you're dating yourself.
Yeah, I was saying the
same. I'm an old man. Anything left like that I can spend my Social Security check?
Boy, there's not much of that left. He's talking about those old Basque restaurants in North Beach where you sat down and they brought the food out. There was a wine tasting group put together by George Linton, one of the first wine importers in the area. And every Thursday there was a dinner at the Basque restaurant. And you only had to call his secretary to let her know you were coming because she had to have a full count. And everybody took a bottle of wine, and all these bottles of wine were on the table. There'd be from 15 to 25 or 30 people each time. And it was a great learning experience because we got to taste all these different wines. And the food was substantial, and there was a lot of it. It was never anything too exciting, but it was just downright good, simple food.
I used to love going to those Basque restaurants when I first moved. I'm dating myself, too. There was also, I remember when I first came to San Francisco, there used to be almost a kind of one-upsman competitiveness, one-up-person competitiveness. Have you tried Ethiopian food? You know, have you had Danish food? Have you had these kind of exotic dishes, Afghan food and so forth? We've got it all covered here now, though. I mean, it's as if they've all become kind of regular part of cuisine and just about every kind of dining, every kind of palate, don't we? What's new and exotic, really? I mean, do we have anything, maybe, I don't know, East Somalian food? Or is there something I don't know about?
No, I'm going
Tanganyika?
To Iceland, so maybe I'll bring back some tips on Icelandic food.
I heard that the food in, actually, Laurent Manrique was telling me about the food in Scandinavia, that he went on a trip to Scandinavia and couldn't believe it, was blown away by the restaurants there and the sophistication of the food. So,
well, some entrepreneur is listening. there you go. Alex, good morning.
Hey, I'm from Boston, and coming all the way to San Francisco, people were telling me about how good the food was here. But having arrived here and started sampling, especially the Italian food, I was incredibly disappointed by the, it just doesn't have the same kind of feel that the Italian food I grew up on has.
I agree with you, Alex. Not only Boston, but New York, much better Italian food, in my judgment, much better deli food. And yet, Michael Bauer, I think you've said you have more pure flavors out here. You have a lot of good fresh food out here.
Right. Well, it's different. I mean, it's a totally different kind of Italian food than what you get on the East Coast. And all of ours is really kind of filtered through the whole California palate. So our Italian foods are really more like Mediterranean. And you have the influence all the way through. But what I was talking about on the difference in flavors, the pure flavors, is I believe the East Coast is more technique-driven in cooking. The West Coast is more ingredient-driven, which makes it much more pure flavors.
But why can't you, for example, get the kind of risotto here that you can get in New York or Boston? There's just no comparison. It's just much tastier and much more fulfilling. Same with just a plain old corned beef sandwich. You know, I mean, this is a joke almost out here compared to the East.
Well, I think, you know, I will defend a little bit. I don't want to address the risotto, but I applaud the regionality of these foods. And New York delis belong in New York. And they don't, they just, some of these foods don't travel. You think they might, but it's just, it's a part of the history and the culture of that city that you can go to the Second Avenue Deli or the Stage Deli and have that sandwich. And people have tried to imitate them here, and no one's ever satisfied. So let's keep. So, you know, we have regional California foods that they take them to New York and it just doesn't work. So I think that that's a wonderful thing. And I don't think we necessarily need to, everything needs to travel. That these regional foods, that they stay in their region, and they're wonderful there. And we can celebrate our own ingredients here, our own things.
Well, that's fine, except everybody in the country is doing California cuisine, and we don't mind their copying our ideas, and we critique them. I don't see any reason why we shouldn't have good deli here. I mean, certainly we don't have waiters that insult you as effectively as they do in New York, and they don't throw the food at you as effectively as they do in New York. But I think we need to let the restaurateurs know that we really will support a good deli. They've come and gone from time to time, but you're right. There is no really classic. I mean, I eat a whole bowl of half dills every time I walk into a deli in New York, just waiting for my sandwich to get there. In San Francisco, people don't even know what a half dill is.
No, but I think that those delis grew out of a strong Eastern European Jewish culture that is very much a part of the culture of New York City, and that doesn't, it just isn't here. So I don't know how to bring those crusty old guys out. You know, we don't grow them here.
But don't they cure the meat differently, too? I mean, it really
is.
Is that just a myth?
There's no, I mean, theoretically, there's no reason why you can't do it. But in my experience, it just doesn't work.
Listen, the same company in Chicago that makes the Hebrew National Franks and the corned beef and the pastrami ships it all over the country. I mean, it's not a difference in a cure. The whole difference in delis, I think, is attitudinal.
Mm-hmm.
There's a place in Ann Arbor, Michigan called Zingerman's that ships it all over the country.
Oh, yeah.
It's damn good.
And
now, here's
he
somebody
is good.
Who puts a knock on Chinese food in San Francisco, believe it or not. Nick says, I recently visited Vancouver and found the Chinese food, mainly Cantonese, there way better than here, not to mention those in Hong Kong. It seems the food critics here still haven't got it when it comes to Chinese food.
Well, wait a minute. Actually, I don't know that the food critics haven't got it so much as maybe the restaurants haven't got
I
the kind of Hong Kong
meant,
flavor
maybe.
He's
but,
looking
but
for.
But the difference, I agree, it depends where he goes. I mean, the Chinese food is now moving out to the suburbs, to Milpitas on the peninsula. That's where all the big restaurants are now. It's not Chinatown. It's not in the city.
Yeah, but you can still go to the House of Nanking, and you can still, I mean.
I've never liked the House of Nanking.
Yeah. You don't want to go there.
If you want atmosphere, you go there, yeah.
There's a real interesting growth in the suburbs, and I think that is really of some of the ethnic foods. And, you know, like I was out in Fremont in the strip malls, you know, and it's just, you know, there's Target and Applebee's and all this stuff. And in there will be just a little tiny shop and, you know, some.
And a good Thai restaurant.
A Persian food or, you know,
Afghan
food.
Lots of Afghan.
Or, you know, like South Indian chat or things like that. And they're in these very bland little malls in this very nondescript little space. And some of that food is phenomenal. It's really interesting. It's really unexpected. But there's communities out there who support that food. And I encourage people to go and explore out there. There's really some wonderful food.
Well, we've got a lot of emails to explore here, too. But let me go to some more calls first before we go there. And Gigi joining us from Menlo Park. Morning.
Good morning, Michael. I wanted to share with you a really wonderful newsletter that I get from a little restaurant tucked away in Menlo Park that my husband and I frequent. It's called Marché. And the newsletter is really fascinating. It has all sorts of idiosyncratic history on food. It has the chef Howard Bolka's monthly missives, which are subjects like why don't people cook anymore, to the history of bouillabaisse. And it's just a wonderful newsletter.
Thank you for that. Appreciate your call. Let me go to some of the emails here. Pam writes, why must restaurants be so noisy? I mean, that's the gist of her remarks here. She's written a long email, but that's too noisy. She's right.
I would like to quote Jeremiah Tower, who, of course, is now only an icon that we think about from the days he was here at Stars, who said, you know, the only thing in the world worse than a restaurant that's too noisy, Narcy, is a restaurant that's too quiet. And, gosh, it would be nice if there were a happy medium, but I really think he's right. When you walk into a place that's too quiet, you wonder what's wrong. Is this a morgue? How come there's no life? How come there's no activity? So getting better acoustics and tempering it a little bit, that's what we really need.
But part of it is the style that we like. I mean, we like the industrial style, the hard surfaces. And to bring in those acoustics are very expensive. So I think that's the reason. So it's kind of a byproduct of our design preferences.
I would agree with Michael. I know when they opened Town Hall, they had that – it's a beautiful space, and they had those high ceilings, and they were loath to do anything to their ceilings. And about 2 months later, I was in there, and Doug Washington, his owner, he says, I'm going deaf. I said, you got to do this for the customers. He's like, I got to do it for me. I can't work here anymore. And they brought in the acoustic specialist, and, late in the game, had to spend a lot of money to fix the problem. But I think people fall in love with the design, and they don't necessarily realize until the restaurant opens and the people are sitting in there just how uncomfortable the noise level can be.
And also, it's age, too. The older we get, I think, the more we want to quiet the restaurant. So.
And the more you start kvetching, too, about things like drafts and all that. Here's Shelley who writes, my husband and I are both waiters and want to comment about the minimum wage and tip income. Even though the minimum wage has gone up, we still don't receive a paycheck. All the money is eaten up by taxes on those tips and by insurance. And still, this is not enough to cover taxes. We still have a big bill with the IRS every year. Granted, we make a good living working at high-end restaurants. It is basically from these tips that we can afford to live in the Bay Area, not because of a high minimum wage. No. And then some comments on from listeners on having to do with weight. Debbie writes, my husband and I love eating out and are gaining weight. Please recommend somewhere in the Silicon Valley that combines healthful cooking with great taste. And we might even say beyond the Silicon Valley, just in Northern California in general. And then George says, we're talking about smaller plates, Michael. Why in this era of obesity are portion sizes at most restaurants so huge? Is there some marketing reason I don't understand?
I don't find portions particularly huge,
no.
I have to say. So I don't see that. I will place all that responsibility on the diner. You know, the restaurant is there to make delicious food. It's your responsibility to eat as little or as much as you want to maintain your own health.
But what about restaurants where you can really get a healthy meal and a meal that may be somewhat, in terms of caloric intake, the restaurateur is more mindful of that? And
what's
it's good
a healthy
food
meal?
But you can at any restaurant. You just have to order right.
You just order right, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
The other thing is when people go out to restaurants, more often than not, they're going to celebrate something. It's not just getting a meal. I remember years ago when I was in the restaurant business, we started adding a couple of we had the second most popular dish on the menu was a loin of lamb covered with duck liver pate and a mushroom d'Uxelles and wrapped in a buttery pastry crust. It was just really a great, rich dish. And I started feeling guilty about it, so I took it off the menu and used the same cut of lamb loin, cut it into thin slices, sautéed it with an onion marmalade and glass de viande. It was an absolutely delicious dish. Within 2 months, it had fallen to the next to the last item in popularity on the menu, and we finally brought back the wrapped lamb loin. People didn't want to be reminded that there was a less caloric or less rich way to eat. They were there to have a good time.
Dare we talk about foie gras? Well, why it came to mind? Because I think the first time I ate venison was at your restaurant, your old restaurant in Berkeley. It was delicious. But then I, we had these pangs of guilt thinking I, ingested Bambi. There's a whole sense now about more mindfulness of diners about what they're eating. And a lot of it is ecological. A lot of it is political.
Please don't worry,
particularly with fish,
that.
Though. The seas and what's...
Please don't worry about Bambi because, first of all, in California... deer are protected and
they're rats with good PR is what my friends put.
That's even a better story. But the ones that you find in the restaurant are grazed on farms in New Zealand, just like cows and sheep are.
But let's talk for just a moment about this growing concern that many people who go out to eat have with, what they're eating and how much it has to do with political issues. I mean, political shouldn't be a part of dining, so says people like Tom Keller, but other people say it's all about dining. It's all about interconnectedness with our environment and all that.
Well, yeah, I would surely agree. I mean, we can't say that when we go out to a restaurant, we're going to forget about the environmental impact if we want to rationalize it by saying we only do it rarely to splurge and at home we eat more environmentally aware. Well, that's a decision an individual makes, but I think it's perfectly appropriate for the environmentalists to say, hey, wait a minute, if farmed salmon is doing evil things to the environment, we should find a way to change it. We should stop eating it. And I support that.
And I think more restaurants do. I mean, if you look at like Fish in Sausalito or Cafe Maritime, you get the little brochure from the Monterey Bay Aquarium on fish that are safe to eat, that you shouldn't be eating, and the ones you should avoid, the whole issue of sustainability.
And what's more dangerous in terms of the species and what maybe has more mercury and,
right,
and all that.
I don't think you can separate. You know, it's so much a part of eating, and I don't think you can necessarily separate the politics or the health issues. But I think the very most important message that people need to understand about eating is that it's about pleasure. And I think that these other issues are key. You know, we can't separate the environment or our health from the pleasure of eating food. But I think people have lost a hold of that message, that eating good food and preparing good food is really an essential pleasure of life. And that's what the point of sitting down at the table and having these meals is about. And when the politics and the health issues override, you know, guide those decisions and override the pleasure of a meal, I think that's really too bad and that we've lost something essential. So I think that that message has been kind of getting buried here.
We lose our essential hedonism is what we lose.
You know, it's key. I don't make light of it. I think that that's a really essential pleasure of life, and people need to. I know so many people's like, oh, you know, eating. You know, who has time to cook? Or, you know, it's like, you know, or it's trying to eat something quickly and all of that stuff instead of really taking the time to enjoy it. And I think you're missing something really important when you miss that.
Yeah, and it's traditional where you pass down cultural values, socialization. So, I mean, I think when we give up the table, we give up a lot more than we think we're giving up.
Absolutely.
Well, let us not give up the table, except we have to give up this hour, unfortunately, because we've come to the end of it. Let me extend thanks to all of you for a fast and fun and most illuminating hour. We're talking with Narcy David, who is food and wine editor at KCBS Radio and culinary expert at Macy's, Michael Bauer, food and wine editor at the San Francisco Chronicle, and Jan Newberry, food editor at San Francisco Magazine. Thank you, one and all. Tomorrow on Forum, we're going to talk about the Schiavo case in the opening hour. Get back to serious. Well, this is food is serious too, of course, but I mean really end of life questions and all of that. And in the second hour, apropos of this hour, we're going to talk about statins. Are they really the way to lower cholesterol? So if you want to eat and gorge yourself, you'll want to hear that hour. Our thanks to our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., Kevin Guillory, and Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.